Chapter 12. Christmas is still here, the ending, and the subject of my discourse. We have all admired the illustrated papers, and noted how boisterously jolly they become at Christmas time. What wassail bowls, robin redbreasts, waits, snow landscapes, bursts of Christmas song. And then to think that these festivities are prepared months before, that these Christmas pieces are prophetic. How kind of artists and poets, to devise the festivities beforehand, and serve them pat at the proper time. We ought to be grateful to them, as to the cook who gets up at midnight, and sets the pudding a-boiling, which is to feast us at 6 o'clock. I often think with gratitude of the famous Mr. Nelson Lee, the author of I don't know how many hundred glorious pantomimes, walking by the summer wave at Margate, or Brighton perhaps, revolving in his mind the idea of some new gorgeous spectacle of Fari, which the winter shall see complete. He is like cook at midnight, si parvulicit, he watches and thinks. He pounds the sparkling sugar of benevolence, the plums of fancy, the sweetmeats of fun, the figs of well, the figs of fairy fiction, let us say, and pops the whole in the seething cauldron of imagination, and at due season serves up the pantomime. Very few men in the course of nature can expect to see all the pantomimes in one season, but I hope to the end of my life I shall never forego reading about them in that delicious sheet of the Times which appears on the morning after Boxing Day. Perhaps reading is even better than seeing. The best way, I think, is to say you are ill, lie in bed, and have the paper for 2 hours, reading all the way down from Drury Lane to the Britannia at Hoxton. Bob and I went to two pantomimes. One was at the Theater of Fancy, and the other at the Fairy Opera, and I don't know which we liked the best. At the Fancy, we saw Arlequin Hamlet, or Daddy's Ghost and Nunky's Pison, which is all very well, but, gentlemen, if you don't respect Shakespeare, to whom will you be civil? The Palace and Ramparts of Elsinore by Moon and Snowlight is one of Lauterborg's finest efforts. The banqueting hall of the palace is illuminated. The peaks and gables glitter with the snow. The sentinels march blowing their fingers with the cold. The freezing of the nose of one of them is very neatly and dexterously arranged. The snowstorm rises. The winds howl awfully along the battlements. The waves come curling, leaping, foaming to shore. Hamlet's umbrella is whirled away in the storm. He and his two friends stamp on each other's toes to keep them warm. The storm spirits rise in the air, and are whirled howling round the palace and the rocks. My eyes! What tiles and chimney pots fly hurtling through the air! As the storm reaches its height, here the wind instruments come in with prodigious effect, and I compliment Mr. Brummy and the violoncellos, as the snowstorm rises, quick, 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 go the fiddles, and then thrumpty thrump comes a pizzicato movement in Bob major, which sends a shiver into your very boot soles. The thunder clouds deepen, bong, 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 from the violoncellos. The forked lightning quivers through the clouds, in a zigzag scream of violins, and look, 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 as the frothing, roaring waves come rushing up the battlements. And over the reeling parapet, each hissing wave becomes a ghost, sends the gun carriages rolling over the platform, and plunges howling into the water again. Hamlet's mother comes onto the battlements, to look for her son. The storm whips her umbrella out of her hands, and she retires screaming in pattens. The cabs on the stand in the great marketplace at Elsinore are seen to drive off, and several people are drowned. The gas lamps along the street are wrenched from their foundations, and shoot through the troubled air. Whist, rush, hish! How the rain roars and pours! The darkness becomes awful, always deepened by the power of the music, and see in the midst of a rush, and whirl, and scream of spirits of air and wave, what is that ghastly figure moving hither? It becomes bigger, bigger, as it advances down the platform, more ghastly, more horrible, enormous. It is as tall as the whole stage. It seems to be advancing on the stalls and pit, and the whole house screams with terror, as the ghost of the late Hamlet comes in, and begins to speak. Several people faint, and the light-fingered gentry pickpockets furiously in the darkness. In the pitchy darkness, this awful figure throwing his eyes about, the gas in the boxes shuddering out of sight, and the wind instruments bugling the most horrible wails, the boldest spectator must have felt frightened. But hark! What is that silver shimmer of the fiddles? Is it can it be the gray dawn peeping in the stormy east? The ghost's eyes look blankly towards it, and roll a ghastly agony. Quicker, quicker ply the violins of Phobos Apollo. Redder, redder grow the orient clouds. Cock-a-doodle-doo. Crows that great cock which has just come out on the roof of the palace. And now the round sun himself pops up from behind the waves of night. Where is the ghost? He is gone. Purple shadows of morn land o'er the snowy sward. The city wakes up in life and sunshine, and we confess we are very much relieved at the disappearance of the ghost. We don't like those dark scenes in pantomimes. After the usual business, that Ophelia should be turned into Columban was to be expected. But I confess I was a little shocked when Hamlet's mother became Pantaloon, and was instantly knocked down by Clown Claudius. Grimaldi is getting a little old now, but for real humor there are few clowns like him. Mr. Shooter, as the grave digger, was chaste and comic, as he always is, and the scene painters surpassed themselves. Harlequin Conqueror and the Field of Hastings, at the other house, is very pleasant too. The irascible William is acted with great vigor by Snoxel, and the Battle of Hastings is a good piece of burlesque. Some trifling liberties are taken with history, but what liberties will not the merry genius of pantomime permit himself? At the Battle of Hastings, William is on the point of being defeated by the Sussex Volunteers, very elegantly led by the always pretty Miss Waddy as Haco Sharpshooter, when a shot from the Normans kills Harold. The fairy Edith hereupon comes forward, and finds his body, which straightway leaps up a live harlequin, whilst the conqueror makes an excellent clown, and the Archbishop of Bayley diverting Pantaloon, and see, perhaps these are not the pantomimes we really saw, but one description will do as well as another. The plots, you see, are a little intricate and difficult to understand in pantomimes. And I may have mixed up one with another. That I was at the theater on Boxing Night is certain, but the pit was so full that I could only see fairy legs glittering in the distance as I stood at the door. And if I was badly off, I think there was a young gentleman behind me worse off still. I own that he has good reason, though others have not, to speak ill of me behind my back, and hereby beg his pardon. Likewise to the gentleman who picked up a party in Piccadilly, who had slipped and fallen in the snow, and was there on his back, uttering energetic expressions. That party begs to offer thanks, and compliments of the season. Bob's behavior on New Year's Day, I can assure Dr. Holishade, was highly creditable to the boy. He had expressed a determination to partake of every dish which was put on the table, but after soup, fish, roast beef, and roast goose, he retired from active business until the pudding and mince pies made their appearance, of which he partook liberally, but not too freely. And he greatly advanced in my good opinion by praising the punch, which was of my own manufacture, and which some gentlemen present, Mr. Omgien, amongst others, pronounced to be too weak. Too weak. A bottle of rum, a bottle of Madeira, half a bottle of brandy, and 2 bottles and a half of water can this mixture be said to be too weak for any mortal? Our young friend amused the company during the evening by exhibiting a 2-shilling magic lantern, which he had purchased, and likewise by singing a lie, come up. A quaint, but rather monotonous melody, which I am told is sung by the poor Negro on the banks of the broad Mississippi. What other enjoyments did we proffer for the child's amusement during the Christmas week? A great philosopher was giving a lecture to young folks at the British Institution. But when this diversion was proposed to our young friend Bob, he said, "Lecture? No, thank you. Not as I nose on," and made sarcastic signals on his nose. Perhaps he is of Dr. Johnson's opinion about lectures, sir. What man would go to hear that imperfectly at a lecture, which he can read at leisure in a book? I never went, of my own choice, to a lecture, that I can vow. As for sermons, they are different. I delight in them, and they cannot, of course, be too long. Well, we partook of yet other Christmas delights besides pantomime, pudding, and pie. One glorious, one delightful, one most unlucky and pleasant day, we drove in a brougham, with a famous horse, which carried us more quickly and briskly than any of your vulgar railways, over Battersea Bridge, on which the horse's hoofs rung, as if it had been iron, through suburban villages, plum caked with snow, under a leaden sky, in which the sun hung like a red-hot warming pan, by pond after pond, where not only men and boys, but scores after scores of women and girls, were sliding, and roaring, and clapping their lean old sides with laughter, as they tumbled down, and their hobnailed shoes flew up in the air frosty with a lilac haze, through which villas, and commons, and churches, and plantations glimmered. We drive up the hill, Bob and I, we make the last 2 miles in 11 minutes. We pass that poor, armless man who sits there in the cold, following you with his eyes. I don't give anything, and Bob looks disappointed. We are set down neatly at the gate, and a horseholder opens the brougham door. I don't give anything. Again disappointment on Bob's part. I pay a shilling apiece, and we enter into the glorious building, which is decorated for Christmas, and straightway forgetfulness on Bob's part of everything but that magnificent scene. The enormous edifice is all decorated for Bob and Christmas. The stalls, the columns, the fountains, courts, statues, splendors, are all crowned for Christmas. The delicious Negro is singing his Alabama choruses for Christmas and Bob. He has scarcely done, when, toot-a-root-a-toot, Mr. Punch is performing his surprising actions, and hanging the beetle. The stalls are decorated. The refreshment tables are piled with good things. At many fountains old claret is written up in appetizing capitals. Old claret, oh, jolly! How cold it is! Says Bob. I pass on. Tea's only 3 o'clock, says Bob. Oh, only 3, I say, meekly. E dine at 7, sighs Bob, and it's so cold. I still would take no hints. No claret, no refreshment, no sandwiches, no sausage rolls for Bob. At last I am obliged to tell him all. Just before we left home, a little Christmas bill popped in at the door, and emptied my purse at the threshold. I forgot all about the transaction, and had to borrow half a crown from John Coachman, to pay for our entrance into the Palace of Delight. Now you see, Bob, why I could not treat you on that 2nd of January, when we drove to the palace together, when the girls and boys were sliding on the ponds at Dulwich, when the darkling river was full of floating ice, and the sun was like a warming pan in the leaden sky. One more Christmas sight we had, of course, and that sight I think I like as well as Bob himself at Christmas, and at all seasons. We went to a certain Garden of Delight, where, whatever your cares are, I think you can manage to forget some of them, and muse, and be not unhappy, to a garden beginning with a Z, which is as lively as Noah's Ark, where the fox has brought his brush, and the cock has brought his comb, and the elephant has brought his trunk, and the kangaroo has brought his bag, and the condor his old white wig and black satin hood. On this day it was so cold, that the white bears winked their pink eyes, as they flapped up and down by their pool, and seemed to say, "Aha, this weather reminds us of our dear home." Cold. Bah! I have got such a warm coat, says Brother Bruin, I don't mind. And he laughs on his pole, and clucks down a bun. The squealing hyenas gnashed their teeth, and laughed at us quite refreshingly at their window, and, cold as it was, Tiger, burning bright, glared at us red hot through his bars, and snorted blasts of hell. The woolly camel leered at us quite kindly as he paced round his ring on his silent pads. We went to our favorite places. Our dear Lambert came up and had himself scratched very affably. Our fellow creatures in the monkey room held out their little black hands and piteously asked us for Christmas alms. Those darling alligators on their rock winked at us in the most friendly way. The solemn eagles sat alone and scowled at us from their peaks, whilst little Tom Rattle tumbled overhead and heels for us in his usual diverting manner. If I have cares in my mind, I come to the zoo and fancy they don't pass the gate. I recognize my friends, my enemies, in countless cages. I entertain the eagle, the vulture, the old billy goat, and the black-pated, crimson-necked, blear-eyed, baggy, hook-beaked old marabou stork yesterday at dinner, and when Bob's aunt came to tea in the evening and asked him what he had seen, he stepped up to her gravely and said, "First I saw the white bear, then I saw the black, then I saw the camel with a hump upon his back." Chorus of children. "Then I saw the camel with a hump upon his back. Then I saw the gray wolf, with mutton in his maw. Then I saw the wambit waddle in the straw. Then I saw the elephant with his waving trunk. Then I saw the monkey's mercy, how unpleasantly they smelt." There. No one can beat that piece of wit, can he, Bob? And so it is all over. But we had a jolly time, whilst you were with us, hadn't we? Present my respects to the doctor. And I hope, my boy, we may spend another Merry Christmas next year. On the chalk mark on the doorpost of the house of a friend of mine, a few inches above the lock, is a little chalk mark which some sportive boy in passing has probably scratched on the pillar. The doorsteps, the lock, handle, and so forth, are kept decently enough. But this chalk mark, I suppose some 3 inches out of the housemaid's beat, has already been on the door for more than a fortnight, and I wonder whether it will be there whilst this paper is being written, whilst it is at the printer's, and, in fine, until the month passes over? I wonder whether the servants in that house will read these remarks about the chalk mark? That the Cornhill magazine is taken in that house I know. In fact, I have seen it there. In fact, I have read it there. In fact, I have written it there. In a word, the house to which I allude is mine, the Diter's private residence, to which, in spite of prayers, entreaties, commands, and threats, authors, and ladies especially, will send their communications, although they won't understand that they injure their own interests by so doing. For I was a man who has his own work to do, his own exquisite inventions to form, and perfect Maria to rescue from the unprincipled early atrocious general, to confound in his own machinations the angelic dean, to promote to a bishopric, and so forth. I was a man to do all this, under 100 interruptions, and keep his nerves and temper in the just and equable state in which they ought to be when he comes to assume the critical office? As you will send here, ladies, I must tell you you have a much worse chance than if you forward your valuable articles to Cornhill. Here your papers arrive, at dinner time, we will say. Do you suppose that is a pleasant period, and that we are to criticize you between the avum and malum, between the soup and the dessert? I have touched, I think, on this subject before. I say again, if you want real justice shown you, don't send your papers to the private residence. At home, for instance, yesterday, having given strict orders that I was to receive nobody except on business, do you suppose a smiling young Scottish gentleman, who forced himself into my study and there announced himself as agent of a cattle food company, was received with pleasure? There, as I sat in my armchair, suppose he had proposed to draw a couple of my teeth, would I have been pleased? I could have throttled that agent. I dare say the whole of that day's work will be found tinged with a ferocious misanthropy, occasioned by my clever young friend's intrusion. Cattle food, indeed. As if beans, oats, warm mashes, and a ball are to be pushed down a man's throat just as he is meditating on the great social problem, or, for I think it was my epic I was going to touch up, just as he was about to soar to the height of the emperor. Having got my cattle agent out of the door, I resume my consideration of that little mark on the doorpost, which is scored up as the text of the present little sermon, and which I hope will relate, not to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.